From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Jarvis Cocker, the founder of the British band Pulp, talks about his life and music. He's just released his first solo album. He founded Pulp back in 1978 when he was still in high school. The band became famous in the 90s. Also, our book critic Maureen Corrigan recommends some nonfiction books to read during the dog days of summer, including one about dogs, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews an album from the late New Orleans clarinetist Alvin Batiste. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Jarvis Cocker recently released his first solo album called Jarvis. He was the founder and frontman of the British band Pulp, which became famous in the 90s, but actually got started in 1978 when Cocker was in high school. He now lives in Paris with his wife and child. Let's get started with a song from Jarvis. This is Don't Let Him Waste Your Time. He wrote this for Nancy Sinatra. She recorded it on a 2004 album. Cocker later decided to record it himself.
Can hang out with all of his friends. You can go and meet his mother and father. You better make sure that's where it ends. 'Cause baby, there's one thing that you gotta know.
Jarvis Cocker, welcome to Fresh Air. So this is your first solo album, and you started Pulp, the band that you were with for so long when you were 15 years old. What were your expectations at age 15 when you started the band?
I don't know. Yeah, I've given rock and roll the best years of my life. I think when I started the group then, you know, it was like I'd wanted to be in a group for a long time, but that wasn't a particularly original thing to think. You know, it was a bit like saying you want to grow up and be a fireman or a astronaut. You know, people just said that. But and I think, you know, when I did start the band, a lot of it was kind of social things. Like I couldn't play sports, so to have a band that was kind of like you could be in a gang. You know, albeit a kind of quite a small gang, but I suppose I kind of thought that maybe I might get girls. They might think that I was a bit mysterious and deep if I was in a band. That failed miserably. That kind of thing. I was this shy child, and I think a lot of people maybe start bands because the kind of socially inadequate, and they think that if they become a pop star, then suddenly all the things in their life will fall into place, and you know they won't have to suffer all those kind of social embarrassments because they can get you can get your minder to do that, or your bodyguard to vet everybody who comes into your social orbit or something. And I think that's probably why a lot of pop stars then go on to have drug and alcohol problems, because when you become famous, that doesn't actually happen. You find that, you know, you're still stuck with yourself, basically. All those kind of foibles and character defects and stuff don't go away.
When you said you couldn't play sports, was that because you weren't very good at it, or was there some kind of physical problem that actually prevented you?
No, I mean, I haven't really got an athletic build, kind of skinny and lanky, and also the spectacles didn't help, and I've got pretty bad eyesight, so if I took them off, you know, I would hardly be able to see the ball, so, you know, it just never really was cut out for sport.
Your eyeglasses, which are big and thick, are kind of part of your image now, too. Were you always wearing glasses like that?
I've been through, I think what happened, they used to have these glasses in the UK, I don't know if they had them over here. If you were on welfare or low income, you could get kind of free spectacles on the National Health Service. But they only had like one style, which was this kind of like thick black frames, kind of like Elvis Costello's glasses when he first started out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were kind of like, if you wore them at school, people just kind of, first of all, they knew that, first of all, they would call you Four Eyes, so original. But then they would also know, they would kind of say, oh, you've got no money, you're a poor person, because, you know, you couldn't afford to have a decent pair of glasses, you just got these free ones from the government. I kind of mortified my mother, I think, because she got me a pair of the National Health glasses as a kind of spare pair, in case I should ever decide to play a sport and they got broken or whatever. And then she kind of paid money for this, you know, what she considered to be a proper pair of glasses. But then the punk rock thing came out, and suddenly, of course, I decided, you know, that I was just going to wear the black glasses because that was the message of punk rock, you know, don't be bothered about social status, all this kind of thing. It's good to be an outsider. It's good to be different. And so this pair of glasses that my mother had spent a fair amount of money on never got worn, and I've kind of stuck with the kind of thick black glasses ever since, really.
Well, I want to play another track from your new solo CD, Jarvis, and this is called From Auschwitz to Ipswich, and it's got a great lyrical hook in it. They want our way of life, they can take mine anytime they like, because God knows, I know I ain't living right. I'm wrong, I know I'm so wrong. Sorry for killing your lyric there. I hate to quote people's lyrics, but this is like an expression that I think is supposed to refer to terrorism, because they're always saying, you know, like they want to change our way of life. They want. Was this song inspired in a way from that?
Well, yeah. I mean, that the first line is kind of a quote from a speech that Tony Blair gave after there were these bombings on the underground system in the UK. And it just got me thinking, because he said, you know, they want our way of life. Like, it just made me, there's something that didn't ring true about it. You know, I don't agree with terrorism. I'm not a sympathiser of people who plant bombs and stuff like this. But, and the thing that got me, I think, was that, you know, it's characterised that, you know, we in the West are supposedly the ones living the good life, and that somebody jealously wants to take our way of life. And then, but then when you look at, you know, like English society, that us, the supposedly the people who are reaping the benefits of Western civilization. And so it seemed that, like, you know, that way of life isn't even working for us, the ones who are supposed to be winning out, and it certainly doesn't work out for the people who get kind of exploited in order to make all these things that are supposed to make us happy. So the song was written as a kind of reaction against the oversimplification of stuff, and this idea also, like, it's like cowboys and Indians, where we are the good guys and they're the bad guys, I think, you know, it's a basic thing that you have to realise that, you know, I'll probably start quoting the lyrics to Ebony and Ivory in a minute, you know, that there is good and bad in everyone. But it's true, you know, it's a very trite phrase to use. But unless you realise that the capacity for good and evil is all within yourself, rather than like, oh, yeah, we're the goodies and they're the baddies, unless you realise that, you know, you've not really got a very realistic understanding of the world, I don't think.
Well, let's hear your song From Auschwitz to Ipswich. And this is from Jarvis Cocker's new CD, a solo CD called Jarvis.
They want our way of life. Well, they can take mine any time they like. 'Cause God knows I know why. Tell you we are going.
it's the end. Why don't you admit it? It's the same from Auschwitz to Ipswich. Evil comes, I know. Not one single soul was saved.
That's from Auschwitz to Ipswich from the CD Jarvis. More with Jarvis Cocker after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jarvis Cocker, the founder and lead singer of the British band Pulp. He recently released his first solo album. It's called Jarvis. You know, Pulp was, I think, probably much more famous in England and than the United States, but Pulp, Blur, Oasis were three really big bands, you know, popular bands. In England,
they called it the Britpop explosion.
So what did you see yourself as being like the indie versions or like the indie alternatives to something else that was going on in England at that time?
The thing was, you know, indie music had been around and people were into it, but it always seemed that it was on the margins. And then something happened in the kind of mid-90s. For whatever reason, and suddenly these bands that normally would just be written about in the New Musical Express, you know, which is like a weekly music paper in England, and just be played at student disco, suddenly this stuff was getting in the proper charts. And it was very exciting because, especially for me, I'd kind of been on the margins of society and working in this indie band, but we'd always wanted to make a connection with a large audience because I kind of was brought up on pop music and I don't know, I just thought that maybe I didn't see why the mainstream always had to be so bland, and the idea of suddenly kind of storming the barricades and being able to get something that maybe had a bit more content, and you know, it really felt like I wanted it to be like a social revolution or something. And unfortunately, it didn't quite have that kind of transforming effect on British society. But I think, you know, people have drawn parallels between the Britpop thing and the Labour's rise to power and Tony Blair becoming the Prime Minister. It was like the idea of a Labour government ever becoming a reality was about, you know, the same as like an indie band getting to number one in the charts. And so when the indie bands did get to number one in the charts, maybe it was kind of like people thought, oh, well, maybe we could have a Labour government then. And we eventually did. And then, unfortunately, the two things kind of, like I say, I wanted it to be some kind of social revolution, the Britpop thing. I also had high hopes for a Labour government, a supposedly more socialist government. And unfortunately, the Britpop thing didn't do anything, and to be honest with you, the Labour government hasn't really done that much for British society either.
So, you know, so you started Pulp when you were 15 and played with various incarnations of the band till just a few years ago. The band changed a lot, like the musicians changed a lot over the years. Why did you keep the name, even though the band kept changing?
Probably just laziness. I don't know. I liked it as a name, you know, because I had this kind of, you know, love of pop music, and I especially I liked the stuff that was supposed to be disposable. I liked, so, you know, pulp with, you know, the kind of idea of Pulp Fiction stuff printed on bad quality paper that you're supposed to just kind of read and then throw in the bin afterwards. And I always kind of preferred pop music to rock music for that reason, that pop music didn't have kind of an inflated sense of its own worth and of its own importance. But I do think that, you know, some pop songs have profoundly affected me, but they don't try to do it. Do you know what I mean? Sometimes rock is very kind of chest-beating and I have my message for the world and you must listen and this song will change your life. And you're kind of, oh, give me a break, please. And but, you know, something like a Phil Spector song, which they were kind of like, you know, very much kind of pumped out a kind of production line kind of fashion. You know, people are still listening to those songs 40 years on. And you know, but they weren't meant to be masterpieces or anything. They were just entertainment. And I generally think that things, music can be profound and stuff like that, but usually by accident almost, or do you know what I mean? It's like it doesn't get it by taking itself too seriously and really striving for profundity.
Well, let's hear one of the songs that you did with Pulp. And I thought we'd play Common People. Would you say anything about writing the song?
Well, this song is Pulp's most famous song, I guess. It's the song that brought us... It was our first big hit after this kind of decade in the wilderness. This was the point at which we realised that we'd kind of connected with some mood that was in the nation at that time. Which is kind of strange because the song is about... Well, it was about a girl that I met when I was at art college. I went down to art college when I was 25, and during that course, I met this girl who said the line to me in a pub that she was from kind of a wealthy Greek family, and she said, I want to live like common people. She wanted to move to Hackney, which is a kind of roughish area of London. And I kind of tried to explain to her that because she was kind of well-to-do and stuff, it wouldn't really be the same. You can't kind of go and live in what you think is a edgy area and all this kind of thing. It's not the same thing because she could always just ring her dad up and he would bail her out of any trouble. So, and it just kind of, you know, it's a thing that's still going on in society now. It's like... I think, you know, people are drawn to those areas or stuff like that. The reason being because there's a vitality to that culture and people who live there. But the reason that there's a vitality there is because life's kind of tough, and so you have to kind of take your pleasures as and when you can. And because life is tough in the week, maybe you really, really go for it at the weekend. And that's something that's born out of necessity. You can't kind of play at that. You can't kind of take a little holiday in that. And so, you know, the song was kind of written about her. And but, I think that's the way songs should work, that you take an incident that happened to you in your own life, and sometimes that actual situation talks about a wider social issue. But I'm kind of mistrustful of songs that try and tackle social issues, and I'm always slightly horrified at myself when I go into that territory. And the only thing I can say in my defence is this thing, that all the songs that I've written that do that kind of thing, they are the starting point is some kind of real event. And this event was talking to a Greek girl in a pub and probably getting slightly pissed off because she didn't fancy me, and so then writing a spiteful song.
So let's hear Common People, and this is from the Pulp CD Different Class.
She had a thirst for knowledge. She studied sculpture at St. Martin's College. That's where I caught her eye. She told me that her dad was loaded. I said, in that case, I'll have room and Coca-Cola. She said, fine. And then in 30 seconds time, she said, I wanna live life.
like common people. I wanna do whatever common people do. Wanna sleep with common people. I wanna sleep with common people like you. What else could I do? I said, oh, I'll see what I can do. I took her to a supermarket. I don't know why, but I had to start it somewhere. So it started there. I said, pretend you got no money. And she just laughed and said, oh, you're so funny. I said, yeah. I can't see anyone else smiling. Are you sure? You wanna live like common people. You wanna see whatever common people see. Wanna sleep with common people. You wanna sleep with common people like me. But she didn't understand. And she just smiled and held my hand.
That's Common People from the 1995 Pulp CD Different Class. My guest Jarvis Cocker is the former frontman of Pulp. He has a solo CD called Jarvis. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Kiri Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Classics Edition of The Federalist, papers by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, in stores and online at bn.com. And from TIAA Cref, helping those who serve others plan for and live in retirement, online at TIAACREF.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Jarvis Cocker talks about falling out of a window, Maureen Carrigan recommends nonfiction books for summer reading, and Kevin Whitehead reviews the final album from the late clarinetist Alvin Batiste.
Outside there's children laughing, the radio plays my favorite song, the sun is shining, oh, and peace broke out in the sound I've ever heard, and baby's coming back to me. Yeah, baby's coming back to me. Yeah, baby's coming back to me. Yeah, baby's coming home.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jarvis Cocker. He's the founder of the British band Pulp. He recently released his first solo album. It's called Jarvis. Here's another song from it. It's called Black Magic, and it was co-written by Cocker.
I woke up in the north. Somewhere that you wanna stay. Yeah, only
were saying that you like pop because it doesn't have those kind of pretentious, you know, the pretentious mission of some rock songs that take themselves too seriously. There's a kind of famous incident in your life at the 1996 Brit Awards, and these, I guess these are British Music Awards.
Yeah, it's like the British equivalent of the Grammys.
Okay. So Michael Jackson was performing on stage, and you crashed the stage. What was your objection to the Michael Jackson performance? Like, what did you want to do by crashing the stage?
Well, it was just, it was a kind of a strange thing. Like I say, the Brit Awards is this kind of, it's the corporate, you know, industry event. And they were very, very, very pleased with themselves that they got Michael Jackson to play, because it, by having him perform at this event, it gave more kudos and made the event seem, you know, important and happening, you know. But the thing about that was that they kind of would let him do whatever he wanted. And he came on and did this, I think he was singing the song Earth Song. And it was just a kind of weird performance where there were all these people in rags and kind of looking ill and stuff. And then he kind of spread his arms in a kind of Christ-like way and touched people. And then suddenly the rags fell off and they were healed. So it was pretty distasteful. Now, you know, I haven't really got much in the way of religious faith. So it wasn't like he offended my deep-rooted Christianity. But the idea of a pop performer kind of pretend, you know, wanting to portray themselves in this kind of Christ-like way. You know, we were talking about egos earlier. That's kind of going a bit far for me.
So had you planned this beforehand, or were you just taken aback by the performance that you thought, I can't stand it anymore?
Well, and the thing was, and you know, I like Michael Jackson's music. I like a lot of his stuff, and so it wasn't as much as a protest at what he was doing. It was also a protest against this event as well. Against the Brit Awards, because basically what was happening was he was performing. Everybody in the room was kind of saying, this is bad, this is too much. But they were prepared for it to go ahead because, like I say, it gave their event some kind of like kudos and stuff. And I thought the hypocrisy of that was pretty bad. And I was saying, this is terrible. And then it was Candida, Doyle, the keyboard player in Pulp, said, well, why don't you do something about it? I said, all right then, I will. And weirdly enough, I guess because we'd performed earlier on in the night, I just started walking towards the stage. And you would have thought there probably would be some security or something. And lo and behold, eventually I just found myself on the stage. I never really expected to get there. And once I was there, I didn't really know what to do. So I think what I ended up doing was bending over and pretending to break wind. Which, you know, in terms of a protest, isn't particularly the most profound thing to do. But, yeah, that was it. It's something that it had certain, you know, repercussions. I mean, it made me in the UK a very recognizable figure, because everybody talked about it, was on the front of the newspapers, and it kind of made my life hell for a while, because I was suddenly like ubiquitous, you know, everybody recognized me wherever I walked, and that kind of did me head in. Like I say, being quite a shy person, I kind of like to keep myself to myself, and I didn't enjoy that part of it. But the positive thing of it is people remember that thing with some kind of fondness, and generally speaking, people thought that it was a valid protest to make. And so, you know.
Did Michael Jackson ever talk to you about it?
He hasn't called in a long time, no.
Can I ask you about another story that was probably all over the papers in England?
And this you can, if you wish.
This is when you fell out of a window.
Oh, no, that was in my obscurity days. Yeah, that was in 1985, when the thought of any form of pop stardom was still a distant pipe dream.
You want to explain what happened?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I was just trying to impress a girl, you know. A lot of those kind of accidents happen because of girls. I'd been to a party the week before where somebody had really impressed me by doing this trick where they went out of one window, stood on the window ledge, reached across the outside of the building and came in through another open window. And I'd been very taken with this and impressed. So I thought I'd do it to impress this girl and maybe, you know, I'd get somewhere with her. Unfortunately, what I just didn't take into account was the windows in her apartment were the hinged type. You know, the ones I'd seen at this party, it was a sash window where you just pull it straight up. But these were hinged and went out. And when you opened the window, it kind of...
It
protruded outside. Mm-hmm. So there was no way you could stand on the window ledge to do it. So I really vastly over calculated my physical strength. We've discussed my lack of sporting prowess. So I thought, in a fit of terrible bravado, that I could go out, hang from the window ledge by my fingers, and then swing over to the other window ledge and then pull myself in that way. Well, I got out the window and I was hanging from the window ledge and then instantly realised that I didn't have the strength to do that. But also came to the unfortunate conclusion that I also didn't have the strength to pull myself back in through the window that I'd just gone out of. And there was only the girl in the apartment and she didn't have the strength to pull me in. And I could feel my fingers starting to slip. So I said to her, look, I'm just going to have to count to three and let go. And she said, no, don't do that. But I just thought it would be better to have a controlled fall than a random fall.
How high up were you? What story was it?
Well, this would be three stories up, I think. It was kind of slightly higher than a double-decker bus. If you imagine a sightseeing bus in New York, just a little bit higher than that. So it wasn't super high, but I did break numerous bones.
In your legs?
Ankle, pelvis, and wrist.
Whoa.
So I was in hospital for a couple of months and in a wheelchair for a while. Did some concerts in a wheelchair, but then, of course, everybody thought that was a gimmick.
Do you actually remember the moment of impact, or is that something that you...
Oh, yeah, I do. I remember letting go of the window ledge, and then because I think you get a foreshortening effect when you look at something from above. So I didn't think it was actually that high, but I let go, and then I can remember thinking, this it's taking longer for me to hit the ground than I thought it would. Then of course I did hit the ground, and I kind of stood up, and my leg moved in a really weird way, like outwards, and I sat straight back down, which is lucky because otherwise I probably would have snapped my pelvis off or something, and that would have been pretty serious. But I knew I'd done something pretty bad to myself, and just kind of wanly cried up, call an ambulance, and eventually an ambulance came, yeah.
Did you spend a lot of time, wishing that you hadn't done that and trying to, obsessing on that one moment that was going to change your life for a long time?
Well, it certainly was a pivotal moment in my life, and it changed a lot of the way that I thought about things. For a start, it made me realise that you kind of think maybe that, in a film, what would have happened would have found that extra ounce of strength to pull myself in through the window. But, I didn't. I just couldn't. And I could have died, and it would have been a really pointless, stupid death. So all those ideas about maybe you having a guardian angel or about your life having some kind of meaning... that kind of went out of the window. That's not supposed to be a joke, but that it's an appropriate
right
turn of phrase. But so it made me reevaluate things that way. And then also just the simple physical fact of having to spend a lot of time laid in bed afterwards kind of gave me time to think of stuff. And also the people I ended up in this hospital with, which was kind of like a recuperation ward, and there were guys like who'd had industrial accidents and stuff like that, and I kind of realised that my injury was nothing. There were some people like who'd been there for a year or something like that, and I don't know, it just made me think that I'd always been a kind of airy-fairy kind of person and thought I was going to live life on an aesthetic level, and I kind of realised that was a load of rubbish and I should just get on and kind of get more involved in life and not kind of float through it.
Jarvis Cocker, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Jarvis Cocker's solo CD is called Jarvis. Here's another track from it. Coming up, still looking for something to read on your summer vacation, our book critic Maureen Corrigan has some nonfiction books to recommend. This is Fresh Air. Last week, our book critic Maureen Corrigan recommended several novels for summer reading. This time, she has three lively nonfiction books to recommend.
In the summer of 1950, 11-year-old Susan Richards Shreve traveled from her home in Washington, D.C. to a rural haven in Georgia, where water play, group sing-alongs, and co-ed hijinks reigned. It sounds like summer camp, but Warm Springs was, in fact, a retreat with a mission— to heal the spirits and bodies of Americans who'd been afflicted with polio before the Salk vaccine was developed in 1954. Shreve, who's the author of 13 novels, has written an engrossing, somewhat offbeat memoir called Warm Springs, about the period between ages 11 and 13 that she spent at the famous sanitarium, where she seems to have been the reigning mistress of misrule. In an anecdote that encapsulates the dopiness and high drama of adolescence, as well as the developing Shreve's outrageous personality, she recalls steering herself in her wheelchair into the boys' ward, where the charismatic Joey Buckley was lying in his bed, recovering from surgery. Shreve writes, "I cannot for the life of me understand now how I had the nerve or stupidity or exhibitionism to wear a sanitary napkin belt around my neck in full view of nurses and doctors and 18 adolescents in the boys' ward. It occurs to me now, considerably more embarrassed for myself in reflection than I was then, that the gesture was an announcement of desire." Shreve's voice throughout this memoir is wry and sometimes wistful when reflecting back on the extraordinary world of the sanitarium. She smoothly navigates between pity-repelling personal recollections and an encapsulated cultural history of polio in the U.S., particularly during the late 1940s and early 50s, when the power of positive thinking prevailed as a national credo. Throughout Warm Springs, she also pays homage to its founder, FDR, the country's most famous polio, as those who had the disease were then called. Roosevelt's hard-won belief in the benefits of what we would now call holistic treatment governed Warm Springs, and his jaunty spirit was everywhere, especially strong, Shreve recalls, in the dining hall, where a chair at the head table was always left vacant. FDR had a beloved first pet named Falla, a Scotty dog. Had he been alive today, the famous Falla no doubt would have penned or pawed his own memoir. Such is the current insatiable demand for dog books, kicked off by John Grogan's mega hit, Marley and Me. As someone who now finds herself the bewildered human handmaiden to a 7-pound Maltipoo puppy, I appreciate those Bowser books that aren't too cute, but instead capture the leaky, stinky truth of rollicking life with Rover. One such canine classic, originally published in 1923 and recently reprinted, is Thomas Mann's little-known waggish memoir about his dog called Bashan and I. I also toss a lifetime award of 3 liver snaps to John Katz, whose many books about dogs have always been enlightening and sane and have underscored the profound truth that dogs, no matter how much we love them, are not furry children. Katz's latest book is called Dog Days, and it's a chronicle, sometimes comic, sometimes mournful, about his life on Bedlam Farm in upstate New York, where he relocated from the suburbs about 3 years ago. In addition to 2 border collies and 2 labs, Katz also tends to donkeys, an 1,800-pound steer named Elvis who tries to sit on people's laps, sheep, goats, and chickens. Though Bedlam is a real working farm, Katz admits that these animals, which he writes about in thoughtful detail, are his main crop. If you harbor fantasies of living far from the madding crowd, Katz's accounts of delivering lambs on a rainy night over the protests of his disintegrating spine will talk you back down to reality. Like Susan Richard Shreve, I also live in Washington, D.C., a muggy, mosquito-ridden bog in the summertime. Teaching summer school some years ago, I'd walk home after classes and be so wiped out by the thick afternoon heat that I'd flop down, turn on the TV, and lose myself in crisp reruns of that highbrow British soap opera, Upstairs, Downstairs. Upstairs, Downstairs has long vanished from the rerun lineup, but I've found its literary equivalent in Juliet Nicholson's book, The Perfect Summer. Published last year in England to celebratory reviews, The Perfect Summer is a light cultural history of the summer of 1911, just before the storm of World War I. Nicholson's delightfully overstuffed account ranges from the ballrooms of the aristocracy, where eligible society maidens were advised to be gorgeous, decorative, and dumb, to the corridors of Parliament, where the inexhaustible Winston Churchill was making his mark, to the scandalous debut of the Ballet Russe, to the docks of London, where Ben Tillett led workers on a strike that paralyzed the shipping industry. As the granddaughter of Vita Sackville West and Harold Nicholson, Juliet Nicholson is endowed with the right set of genetic calling cards to research a book like this. She's also savvy enough to acknowledge that the sunlit, perfect summer of 1911 wasn't perfect for every class of British citizen. But like the other books I've mentioned here, Nicholson's lively history makes for perfect summer reading.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Warm Springs by Susan Richard Shreve, Dog Days by John Katz, and The Perfect Summer, England 1911, Just Before the Storm, by Juliet Nicholson. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by clarinetist Alvin Batiste, released shortly before he died. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Until he passed away a few weeks ago, Alvin Batiste was New Orleans' premier modern jazz clarinetist. He'd come up in the 1950s, playing with other Crescent City progressives like drummer Ed Blackwell and pianist Ellis Marsalis. Later, Batiste toured or recorded with Ray Charles, Cannonball Adderley, Billy Cobham, and the Reed Quartet Clarinet Summit. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a Batiste album which was released a month before his death.
Edward Perkins singing a tune by clarinetist Alvin Batiste over drummer Herlin Riley's classic New Orleans parade groove. Batiste's influence was greater than his fame, but it wasn't because of his fine clarinet playing. In 1969, he'd founded the jazz program at Southern University in Baton Rouge, where his students would include Herlin Riley, pianist Henry Butler, saxophonist Branford Marsalis, Donald Harrison and Wes Anderson, and American Idol's Randy Jackson. But with all his academic duties, Batiste recorded far too little. He had a broad, open sound in the clarinet's low and high registers, and he liked to hop between the two. You can hear as much on a bluesy ballad he knew from the 1940s, "I Wonder Where Our Love Has Gone." Those bird call leaps echo Duke Ellington's clarinetist Jimmy Hamilton, who played with Batiste in the 80s group Clarinet Summit. Alvin Batiste died peacefully at home in New Orleans in early May, hours before he was to play an album release gig at the city's Jazz and Heritage Festival. The album in question, Marsalis Music Honors Alvin Batiste, was conceived by his old pupil and label honcho Branford Marsalis, who joins in on saxophones here and there. Marsalis picked the fine rhythm section of Herlin Riley, pianist Lawrence Fields, and bassist Ricardo Rodriguez. On Bumps, they bring out the Cuban rhythms always lurking behind New Orleans syncopations. Alvin Batiste had set himself a hard task as a forward-looking modernist in New Orleans, where traditional clarinet players got all the steady gigs. That he only recorded four albums under his own name is a little ridiculous. Good as he sounds on his new one, I should point out that his friend Edward Perkins lends vocals to four tracks where one or two would have been enough. But then, that was typical of Alvin Batiste. He'd promote other musicians, even at his own expense.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed the album Marsalis Music Honors Alvin Batiste on the Marsalis Music label. If you'd like to catch up on recent editions of our show, you can download podcasts by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Anne-Marie Baldonado. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from The Dial Press, publisher of The Archivist's Story by Travis Holland, a tale of suspicion and courage set in Moscow in 1939. From the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable. On the web at grdodge.org. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the difficulties of teaching in inner city high schools. We talk with two Philadelphia public school teachers who were attacked on the job. Frank Bird's neck was broken. Ed Klein's jaw was broken. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.